like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. Thank you, committee, for being here Tuesday, April 28th. We're going to start out with House Bill 3004. We want to bring up the Dash 5 and Dash 6 amendments. We're under discussion. And we want to continue that discussion, so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3004. And I'd like to call up Legislative Council first and maybe give a description of the two amendments before us and how they impact this bill. And thank you, Sean, for showing up. I don't know if you're still trying to get things out before Tuesday the 28th, but...
Things fortunately have quieted down just a little bit, Chair Hovey, and for that we're a little grateful.
But thank you.
My name is Sean Brennan, the Legislative Counsel, for the record. To go over... Here's that I brought the wrong file, actually. To go over briefly without...
Do you need to go get your file? I can bring somebody else up.
That would be great. If I can go do that, it'll take me 5 minutes.
Certainly. We know where you live.
Okay.
I'll be right back.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to bring up... who do I want to bring up? Chris and Mr. Helmick. And... Yeah, why don't we just start there? I don't want to be too redundant of what we've already gone over with the committee, but I just want you to review the Dash 5 and what it's supposed to do, and I appreciate that.
Chair Hovey, members of the committee, Chris Schultz representing Guerrilla Capital. With me today is John Helmick, the CEO of Guerrilla Capital. I explained the amendments in some detail previously. Be happy to answer any questions about the amendments. John has a little bit of new information about this issue of trustees not providing the deed within 10 days that I think he'd like to share with you and also answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman and committee members. John Helmick, CEO of Guerrilla Capital. Most trustees in Oregon are able to provide a trustee's deed within 10 days. They call the auction. They set the timetable for the auction. Once they call the auction, they should be able to deliver the trustee deed within 10 days as required by statute. We've had a situation in the last 2 years that a lot of out-of-state trustees are not delivering the trustee's deed in time. Here's an example for today. 18 days ago, Guerrilla Capital bought a house at foreclosure auction in Marion County. That deed was supposed to be delivered 10 days later. Today, 18 days later, no deed. We contacted the trustee for the fourth time today, and the trustee told us that they've decided to unwind the sale. So after 18 days, we have no deed, and now suddenly we've learned that we don't own the property. In the meantime, what are we supposed to be doing? Repairing the property? Can we repair the property? Who's owned the property for the last 8 days? No one knows. It's really frustrating that we're trying to conduct a business that is time-sensitive, that the trustee has complete control over until the date of the actual auction, and then after that, they only have one thing left to do, and that is to deliver the trustee's deed to the purchaser within 10 days. 18 days ago, Guerrilla Capital provided the trustee with cash money, a cashier's check, for the full purchase price. That's required at foreclosure auctions. 18 days later, we don't know whether we own this property or not. The statute says after 10 days, the trustee's deed is to be delivered to the purchaser. That's not happening. We need to get trustees to start obeying the law.
Thank you. I think that's pretty straightforward expressing the problem. And I know the Dash 5 amendment is supposed to address the solution to that. And so I'm going to go ahead and have Legislative Council come up now and try to move on with a description of the Dash 5 amendment.
Good
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Members of the committee, Sean Brennan again for the record from Legislative Council. The Dash 5 amendments amend 86755, which is the it's a trust deed statute that talks about what the actual trust deed form needs to be and who you need to send it to. And in addition to the number of people that are listed in subsection 5 and 6, we are adding in there people who are required to get the trust deed, people who give their addresses at the time the trustee sale happens or at the time that the notice of sale is required to be sent. And then there are other provisions that outline what the contents of the trust deed, the amended notice of sale must have. And then if we move to page 4 of the bill, the only other real significant piece of this amendment is in an amendment to 86990, which is the penalty section of that chapter. And the penalty section now in the Dash 5 amendments has been amended so that it's now going to be $50 each day for a total of $2,500, a maximum total of $2,500 for the failure to execute and deliver the trustee's deed after the sale, within 10 days after the date of the sale. And that really is the essence of what that amendment does. The rest that you see in there are conforming amendments.
Thank you. Questions at this point for Sean? Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sean, I understand the Section 2 part, but in Section 1, what is the remedy that a potential interested buyer has if this law is not followed and they aren't notified? I mean, ultimately, they miss out on the sale of the home, right? So they don't get a chance to be a bidder at the auction. And we're creating, I mean, this amendment is saying they must be notified. So I'm wondering, what's their action if they don't get what the law requires?
And Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, there really isn't much in the way of, if I remember correctly, it's been a little bit since I've actually read this section of the law, but if I remember correctly, if you don't get an actual notice of sale, that doesn't necessarily mean that the sale is invalid. In fact, the sale goes through, but I think that you do have certain redemption rights in certain cases, and I would have to actually go back and review that to give you an adequate answer for that question. But there are limited amounts of remedy that you have if you do not get the notice of sale, and I'm hoping that's addressing your question, unless it was having to do with whether you don't get the trustee's deed of sale.
Follow up? Yeah, I guess I just want to understand, if we're about to give somebody a right to be notified, what is their recourse? You know, you're telling me you can't unwind the auction. So, I'm just trying to have an understanding of what I'm giving somebody, when I'm voting to give somebody a right, what their remedy would be if they are wronged.
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, in this case, we're giving the right of the purchaser at the trustee sale will have the ability then to compel the person who is actually selling the property, the trustee in this case, to give them that residential trust deed that basically gives them title to that property. And in that case, they are able to then alienate the property further. If they wish to, they can sell it, they can dispose of it in some other way once they have the title and the evidence of the title. Their remedy without that, I don't think there is one right now.
You're talking about Section 2?
I'm talking about the penalties that are there in Section 2. Those are actually that's incentive for the person who's supposed to give that trust deed
to be able
to fork it over.
But I was talking about Section 1, where they have a right to be notified of a future sale if an auction is postponed. I'm just trying to figure out what their remedy is if they don't get it. If they give their name and they're not notified of a future sale, in other words, if the person who we're now instructing to collect all their names and notify them of the future auction doesn't follow through, what is the potential bidder's remedy?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard, I see what you're saying. If I recall correctly, and I'd have to actually look at this again to be sure. Uh, I would have to get back to you on that. I'm sorry to say. I don't actually have a good idea of how that works in this particular section. I haven't had a chance to read it recently, and my apologies. I certainly can do that afterwards.
We can certainly follow up with that, and maybe someone else in the, will have an opinion on that, too. So,
Mr. Chair, I have a question, but after this man is through testifying.
Oh, okay. Is there any other questions for Sean Brennan on the Dash 5 amendment? Okay. Sean, if you don't mind staying for a little bit, we may want to bring you back up, if that's okay. I'd like to Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, it seems to me that we have two issues here, I'm assuming, maybe three issues. Guerrilla Capital, the Dash 5 amendments that they're interested in, deals with one issue.
Correct.
The Mrs. Cummins, who came earlier, has another issue totally unrelated to this, in a
Correct.
Sense.
Correct.
They have the same relating
In a sense, they're not maybe
right.
totally unrelated, but it's pretty much right. unrelated.
So I guess what I'd like to hear from you is if you're interested in passing the original bill or just the Dash 5 amendment, are you interested in the Dash 6 amendment?
I'm reviewing both, as I mentioned at the beginning, the Dash 5 and the Dash 6 amendments right now. And
okay.
so, you know, it'll be up to the committee on whether we have the votes to pass the Dash 5 or the votes to pass the Dash 6 amendments.
Okay, thank you.
So, I believe Mr. Hagedorn, I wanted to have him come up because he's got a different perspective on the Dash 5 amendments than we've heard yet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, Drew Hagedorn here today on behalf of the United Trustees Association. The United Trustees oppose the Dash 5 amendments to this bill. I don't think we'd take issue with Guerrilla Capital when they say there is a problem here, but going back to what you said, Mr. Chair, we do disagree with this as the solution. We'd ask that the committee not rush to pass amendments that some stakeholders have concerns with. We met with Guerrilla Capital's lobbyists and their representative prior to this hearing and offered to work with them over on the Senate side concerning amendments that could work to both parties, and I know my client is already coming up with some concepts that would work that, so we'd ask you not to amend the bill. I can get into the specifics of some of our concerns if you'd like to hear. First, in Section 1, Subsection 6C, we believe that this would require trustees to do uncompensated work.
Could you give us the line, please? I'm sorry, Mr.
Yes.
Page
One moment,
please.
We're looking at page 3, and that starts on line 5. To line 9 of page 3, the boldface language there. We believe that will require trustees out of their own pockets to provide notice to companies like Guerrilla Capital, and that trustees ought not have to foot the bill for that service, that those in the business of purchasing foreclosed properties ought to foot the bill for that. We have some notions about a potential amendment. One would be to require trustees to post on their websites, for example, the notice of foreclosure, or also to charge a fee, a nominal fee stipulated in statute for providing that notice so that trustees aren't bearing the costs that ought to be placed elsewhere. We also have some concerns about Section 3.2. That language is representative on page 4, beginning on line 10 to line 15.
Mm-hmm.
I just learned about this amendment at noon today, and that my client was concerned about it about 4 o'clock. And I'm not entirely certain exactly what their concerns there are, but they do also have some ideas about appropriate amendments there. I think that they relate just to the fact that this doesn't work for them from a timing standpoint. Then finally, in Section 5, lines 18 to 20 there, the term sales on line 19, we don't think the timing of that works. We think what they're actually meant to tie it to was the foreclosure notice not the sale of the property in question. So that's more of a technical issue, but something that's of a concern. And given those three issues, we'd ask this committee to hold off amending the bill with the Dash 5s. Again, we would commit to working with the proponents of the Dash 5s on the Senate side to address this matter.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On Section 3-2, it seems to me that if there's a concern about this, then you must not be following what is required now. Is that true?
Yeah. No, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. Let me read to you from what was sent to
Please.
You, if that'd be okay, because these issues are new to me, and I apologize to the committee for that. But what they had suggested as a change to the proposed Dash 2 would be to allow the trustee within 10 days of the date of sale to declare the sale as void and then return the purchaser's fund with some set amount of interest to make them whole at the date of the trustee's sale. And then if the trustee refunds the purchaser's money within 10 days following the sale, they wouldn't necessarily have recourse against the trustee or of the beneficiary related to the trustee voiding the sale. So that was the idea of the amendment that they had to advance to address that issue. And I'd shared a little bit of that with the proponents prior to the hearing.
Follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
So I'm trying to understand, because this is a little bit new to me.
Mm-hmm.
What would cause the sale to be voided?
I'm sorry, I can't answer that question. I'd have to get back to you on that. I don't want to give you any misinformation.
Okay.
There may be others in the room with better technical expertise than I have that could answer that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to have Mr. Helmick come back up for a moment. Mr. Helmick, there was two questions that were asked from this committee that we didn't get answers to. One being from Representative Wingard.
Who had to go to another committee.
And who went to another committee, but maybe you could shed some light on that. What happens when somebody under Section 1 of this Dash 5 amendment doesn't get the notices that are required? And then Representative Riley's question.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, be happy to. First of all, the Oregon statute does provide for
And could you restate your name for the record?
John Helmick, CEO of Gorilla Capital. The Oregon statute currently provides for a penalty for failure to give notice of the sale. It's ORS 86.742, failure to give notice of sale, action by omitted person, defense, pleading and proving knowledge of sale, attorney's fees, exclusive remedy. Basically, the sale is valid, even if someone didn't receive notice. So if a junior or senior lien holder or anyone else who is required to receive notice under the Oregon statute does not receive notice, they have an action against the trustee for the failure to receive notice. The law is very well written. The person must prove, to have any damages, the person must prove that they had the cash ready and able to bid that day. So it's a very good law that takes into account all the different possibilities of someone who should get notice. For example, a second lien holder is foreclosing and the first lien holder doesn't get notice. So it's a very well-written statute, and I think it covers everything. It would certainly cover the situation where someone who has requested notice of the trustee doesn't receive notice and can show all the different elements to show damages, and they receive an award for their damage.
Okay, thank you. And what was your second question again?
What would cause a sale to be void?
A number of different issues could occur. First of all, the house could have been sold and the mortgage paid off. And in this day and age, believe it or not, that does happen. We've been, Gorilla Capital has been involved in a situation where we purchased a house at foreclosure, mm-hmm. and 2 weeks later we found out that the loan had been paid off and the house was sold and the loan was paid off at the sale. Right hand didn't know what the left hand was doing. The lender wasn't talking to the trustee. They didn't tell them to stop the sale. The trustee and Gorilla and the lender resolved it.
So it seemed like that situation would have to be somewhat accounted for in statute, then, that doesn't probably exist in the Dash 5 right now.
The proposed amendment, as orally stated, Gorilla Capital has no problem with that. In fact, recent court cases sort of indicate that's what the courts believe, that 10-day period gives this trustee the ability to void the sale if they find out, whoops, we screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that 10-day period is for. What isn't addressed is what happens when the trustees violate the Oregon statute and fail to deliver that trustee's deed, which is evidence of ownership, and the only evidence of ownership the buyer has. Trustee has the money. We're supposed to get the trustee's deed.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you both very much for testifying on the Dash 5 amendment. I think I'd like to hear about the Dash 6 amendment, if I could have Sean come back up just briefly and run us through what the Dash 6 amendment does.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. The Dash 6 amendments do two main things.
And could you introduce yourself again for
I'm
the
sorry,
record?
Sean Brennan, Legislative Council. And let me actually find the text of the language itself. In the Dash 6 amendments, in subsection 2, which is the substantive section that we're looking at, it's on page 2, lines 19 through 24. What that does is requires that, except for exceptions that we have later in subsection 4, after a trustee sale happens, then there's no possibility for a person who has an interest in the property to bring an action against the grantor in the trust deed after that foreclosure. The basic idea here is that if you choose to foreclose on the property, then you are no longer able to bring an action for a deficiency on that property if you've gone through the foreclosure. That's the policy in subsection 2. That's just a blanket policy for all actions that might be brought against the grantor and the trust deed after a trustee sale. We have a carve-out from that blanket, except that blanket ban, however, in subsection 4. And there, the section that we're interested in here is this paragraph C, beginning on line 12 on page 3 of the amendments. There is enough possibility for an action for a deficiency against the grantor if the person who is bringing the action meets these three criteria set out in A, B, and C, lines 15 through 19. There, if the grantor has not actually foreclosed on the trust deed, then they are able to bring the action. If they also do not receive proceeds from the trustee's sale, and they are not named as a trustee or beneficiary in the residential trust deed that was foreclosed. The idea here being that there are legitimate interests who have the possibility of, or need the possibility of suing for deficiency in this case because they have no other way to secure the loan that they've given. Now, yesterday when there was some testimony as to the fact that we are not covering all situations where in fact, there might be the possibility that somebody would be able to sue for a deficiency if, in fact, they were, say, the 20 on an 80-20 loan split. And that is, in fact, the case. There is the situation that would be covered in that case is if the 80% loan and the 20% loan were split into different ownership at some point in the chain that happens after the loans are originated and then sold and packaged. The person who holds the 20% could potentially, under even these amendments, sue to have a deficiency judgment against the grantor. And that can be remedied in amendment. It does not exist right now in the Dash 6s.
All right. Questions? Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am struggling to understand the legal verbiage and what exactly it means, but I do understand the goal of this legislation, and that is, no matter how many people own pieces of it, once a property is foreclosed, the person who has lost their home should no longer have financial responsibility. If I heard you correctly, what you just explained, for the second part of that, the exception really doesn't grant that protection that this bill is seeking to accomplish. Is that correct?
Chair Hovey, Representative Cohen, it gets us most of the way there, but not all of the way. There is a particular instance where, in fact, there's if the loan is split into two different owners, the second owner on the, say, for example, the 20% second mortgage or second lien, would in some instances be able to sue for deficiency. So in that sense, we aren't all the way there. We are most of the way there, though, I think. And if there was a further amendment to the bill, I think we could probably get all of the way there. But, of course, that's not necessarily a possibility right now.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I don't know if you've had the opportunity to see this maze that we looked at last night, but having tried to make some sense of that, it appears to me that oftentimes, well, frankly for all of us, I have no idea who's holding the whatever it's called on my house. I know to whom I make my payments, and that's about it. So how does one know whether something has been satisfied or not?
Chair Hovey, Representative Cohen, that's a question I think we probably should ask Mr. Cardassin, is it? He actually was the person who brought that chart in, and he's been able to actually track some of the way that the ownership does get split of that particular mortgage. I'm not sure exactly how many different ways it can be split. The general process is that once you package it and originate this loan, you can split the ownership of the loan into many different owners because you can sell it as a security or sell it to be broken into securities and then from there repackaged and sold in many different ways. That does raise the question of who actually does own the loan at some point. But again, for the purposes of this amendment, what we're looking at here is getting, again, most of the way there. The difficulty lies in trying to grant those people who really should have some ability to sue for deficiency because they have no other way to secure the loan that they've made to on this property, and those who, for policy reasons, shouldn't be allowed to sue because they have had their bite at the apple with the first lien, at least at the time of origination.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wonder if we get Mr. Carnes up
It was Mr. Carnes.
Mr. Chair, I did hear the explanation last night. I'm not sure that repeating it will help.
Will help.
Yeah.
I
agree.
Yeah. Well, I don't want you to go over the chart, Mr. Carnes.
No, please.
I didn't bring the chart, Chair Holby and members of the committee. I agree.
For the record, your name, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Keith Carnes. I agree essentially with legislative counsel that with one small change, I showed you how the mortgages get spread to the four winds, and I could have brought some cases with me, but elected not to. I'm afraid I did more confusing than explaining yesterday. I think with a small amendment that we could do on the Senate side, we could say that in subsection C on line 18 of page 3...
Of the original bill?
Of the dash six amendments on line 18... Not is, instead of saying is not the trustee, saying was not the original trustee or beneficiary. And then we would have the situation where the loan started out together with one originator as an 80-20. It doesn't matter what happens after that. That 20 is now tied to the foreclosure. I think with that one small amendment, we would then be to the point that I understood we were trying to start from. But we would still allow somebody to sue on a deficiency if they are the originator of a loan of a home equity line of credit or some other subsequent transaction after the origination of the loan. Great. I think with that one amendment, we would have this problem solved. And I think that I'm more than happy to go to the House or go to the Senate and ask them to do that and explain what I tried to, but more clearly, that's what this bill is getting at.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both for coming in. Mr. Brennan, also thank you in particular. You guys have been busy lately. You've done a lot of good work, and we worked together on one thing. I think I got the email from you at like 2:24 a.m. I really appreciate everything you've been doing. A question for both of you, actually. Of course, any time we pass a bill in this body, there's always a risk of unintended consequences. Indeed, that is often, for example, on a relative consensus bill, as I suspect this one is, I think most of us agree on the intent, that is always the biggest risk. And I'm wondering, just because this isn't my area of law, I feel like I don't know what I don't know, and I'm just concerned that there's something here we're missing, that there's something we're going to have to fix. I'm wondering if you guys could gauge what you think that risk is, if there's something we're not thinking, if the risk of unintended consequences here is either A, large, it's high probability we make an unintended error, or B, even if it's low probability, that unintended error is of extraordinary consequence. Those are the two things I'm worrying about, and I'm wondering if either one of you guys could comment on that. Actually, both of you, please.
Well, Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, I appreciate it, and the reason I became involved in the bill in the first place was my concerns, as I mentioned, that we would be undoing the current state of the law and that, you know, I wanted to put my labor into fixing that. I've gone through this, you know, my law firm has attorneys. I'm one of the least experienced attorneys as far as, you know, years-wise. I deal more with foreclosure, but I had three attorneys review this. I've read this literally 10 times, going over thinking, what's the loophole in this one? And I'm not finding it. To the extent that there may be something, the only thing I could, as I racked my brains, think, what is the one loophole in this? If I went to my mortgage broker and he did an 80-20 for me, the 80 is with ABC Bank and the 20 is with XYZ Bank, I wouldn't have the protections. But my experience in all the bankruptcy and all the mortgage litigation that I've done is that 99 times out of 100, at least of the ones that I've seen, the 80 and 20 are done with the same bank. And so with the one amendment, I think it seals it up, and I think it's good to go. I didn't graduate cum laude, but, you know.
Nor did I, Mr. Carnes. It's okay.
And so I don't want to go make any guarantees on anything, but I think that the bill doesn't really have much room to breathe other than that. And I think Mr. Brennan did an exceptional job of drafting it. And if we just made that one change, I think we'd be there. I mean, that's my opinion.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton. I think we are most of the way there, with the one exception that we may need to try and take care of to fully implement the intent of the bill. In that sense, I don't think there's any unintended consequences that would flow from it. The only other consequence that I might see in this, and this would be a lot bigger picture view of it, is to the extent that this does keep those folks who are the 20s and the 80-20 split from going and getting their deficiency judgment, as they will be able to do under current law, it may push them into doing slightly different arrangements, maybe more toward the mortgage side rather than the trust deed side. But I think that possibility is actually relatively small. And the reason I say that is because trust deeds in Oregon exist in part because of the ease with which the people who hold the liens on the house can actually go through a trustee sale as opposed to going through judicial foreclosure. They don't have all the attendant court costs with that, and there are other advantages that go along with trust deeds. I think that that is a possibility. I think it's a very, very small possibility, and that the costs and other difficulties that come along with having a mortgage as opposed to a trust deed will probably still weigh in favor of having the trust deeds.
Follow up. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With that being said, because you said on the person holding the 20% is going to have less recourse on the property, do you think this might eliminate people doing the 20% loan?
Chair Holvey, Representative Widener, I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think there are a lot of that will, of course, we'd have to ask a loan originator about that, really, to see what kinds of interest people would have in arrangements like that. My understanding is that many people who got into mortgages in the first place did it through an 80-20, in part to avoid private mortgage insurance and the payments that go into that, and also that it made it a lot more affordable for people to do that. In today's loan climate, it might not be as easy to do, but that, I think, is more of a business decision. And for those lenders who actually do want to increase their client base and be able to make the kinds of loans that they want to, I think they will still make those kinds of arrangements even then. And, of course, as as has been pointed out before, many of these loans simply get sold immediately and repackaged, so the initial lender, whoever it might be, will not have that same risk. It might be somebody later on that they sell it to, and that might make it more difficult to actually do those kinds of securitizations and repackagings, but I don't know that it would necessarily affect people's ability to get an 80-20 type of mortgage, though. And again, I'm not a mortgage professional, so it's not really my area of expertise to be able to tell you fully what might be the consequences there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Barton.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. I wanted to, again, appreciate these gentlemen have put a great deal of work, not just into this, but in many other bills. And truly, good lawyering is appreciated when we see it. And thank you.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I don't want to keep you, but I'd like you to hear a couple other folks on this before I move on. Mr. Martinez, would you like to comment on the Dash 6 amendment? No? No comment?
Dash 3.
So... Is there anybody else who would like to comment on the Dash 6 amendment? Mr. Cummins? And if you could be short, we've heard the reason why we need this bill from you before, so...
I have one comment.
Okay. Please,
Mr. Chair, and
introduce yourself for the record.
Jane Cummins, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Representative Barton asked about unintended consequences. As I read through the court case in the 90s, it was clear from that case from Judge Warren that one of the problems was that there could not be found a clear indication as to what the legislature intended. So my plea is that when you do particularly consumer protection bills, that you clearly state what your intent is so it's in the record in case in future times courts have to look at it. Thank you.
My name is Art Cummins, and I'm an attorney in private practice in Salem, and I've been doing it for 42 years now. And I agree with what Mr. Carnes had to say. I think this bill can be fixed and made correct and meet the intent of which we brought this to the legislature's attention. What I want to say, you mentioned a couple of things, the risk of unintended consequences. The reason that we're here is that the federal court and the state court pointed out unintended consequences, and we're closing that loophole. I believe that once that loophole is closed, we're not going to have unintended consequences in this bill. Normally, from my experience, 80-20 loans are done with the same bank, and that then would this bill would apply, and it may well change a little bit about how we do business, but when they make loans, it's a business transaction, and they have to concern themselves with the consumer's credit and the availability of money. And you remember the old days was you put up 20% cash and they financed the rest of it, and that wasn't a bad way to do it. And maybe we need to re-examine overall the banks as to how they lend money so that people who don't get encouraged to enter into transactions that they can't afford. The last thing I want to mention to you is the reason this trust deeds law came into effect is because the industry didn't like mortgages. Why didn't they like mortgages? Because the consumer had 1 year to redeem that mortgage after they took the property, basically, which meant they couldn't take the property because you couldn't pass title without having this 1 year that the owner of the property could come in and take it back. The trust deed law was set up to avoid the consequences of mortgages, particularly with residential transactions. And the last thing I want to mention is the second note that we brought up in our written testimony that is the killer to the consumer. That's all part of the original purchase money transaction. The lender has 6 years to sue on that. So the poor consumer sits there for 6 years waiting you, and as you all know, statute of limitations, we file accident cases one day before it runs. So they may be waiting for 6 years with this over their head and an inability basically to get credit for 6 years. The only thing they can do then to avoid that, if they otherwise qualify, is to go to bankruptcy, either a Chapter 13 or a Chapter 7. And if that's what we want the Oregon consumer to do when they've lost their property, I don't think that's what we want them to do. And I would follow the lead of the federal court and the state court and close this loophole, and I think we'd have an act that the lenders can live with and will protect the consumers. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Cummins? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to recess for just a few minutes. Reopen the House Committee on Consumer Protection. Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 3004.
Representative Riley moves the Dash 6 amendment to House Bill 3004. Discussion? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the idea behind this bill, and I like what they're trying to do, but it concerns me a little bit on young homeowners that are trying to get in their first homes, and I'm just worried that we could be hurting them on the ability to actually get out and purchase a home. So that's the concern I have with this bill, and I will be a no on all the amendments, but I think it's something we need to straighten out and could fix with amendments. We're just a little late in the game right now.
Right. I appreciate that concern. That I also have that similar concern. I feel comfortable that the small word change in this is a good change, and I think we can get it over to the Senate to have a second pair of eyes on this and to make those changes and to have another round of discussions at that point. I don't believe now that I'm... we'll speak to that in a minute, but I think that I'm comfortable with this. Representative Callan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I too have grown comfortable with the Dash 6, and I apologize for the time, but I just want to take a moment to thank the folks that have helped us and helped me work through this and understand, and I hope my comments weren't in any way taken as derogatory or disparaging of the maze that Mr. Carnes presented to us, because it was really pretty fascinating to realize just how complicated this is. And I know the amount of time that he's put in on this effort, pro bono, if you will, and I really do appreciate that effort. So I just needed to say thank you.
Thank you. And Cindy, no other comments. Can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Barton.
Aye.
Representative Callan.
Aye.
Representative Gilliam.
Excused.
Representative Krieger.
Excused.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. Dash 6 amendments to House Bill 3004 are adopted.
Is there a subsequent amendment?
No. And I'm not going to entertain the Dash 5 amendments on this. I think hopefully they'll be able to be followed up on the Senate side and work that language out a little bit better than what it is. The language seems to be a little bit too far off at this point, I think, to encumber this bill any more than it's encumbered. So, Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 3004 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 3004 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief, but I just want to kind of take this back to where we started, which was the Cummins family came forward because their daughter and son-in-law had purchased the home of their dreams in the neighborhood they wanted, and they wanted that home badly. And then the son-in-law lost the job and could not afford to keep that house. And I really am sympathetic to that situation. I think the result of this bill will probably be less 80-20 loans being offered, a reduction in that. And in comment to my colleague's comment about the fact that young couples won't be able to buy the homes, I think they won't be able to buy the homes that they can't afford. But even in this case, even if this bill were enacted, the only thing this would have done, it wouldn't have prevented the foreclosure because ultimately he lost his job. So really, it still does come down to individual responsibility, purchasing within your means and live within that. But I do support the bill and what it tries to do, and I really appreciate the Cummins family. You've been here now 4 nights, I believe, and I appreciate the effort you've made. So thank you, and those are my comments, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. I agree with much of what you said as well. But I also think it's incumbent upon the lending industry to make sure people can afford to pay for the loans they take out or the loans they lend people as much as possible. And so with that, I would like a roll call vote on the bill, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative
Cowan? Aye.
Representative Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 3004 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, Mrs. Cummins suggested that we state very specifically what our intent is here. Is there anything that we need in case there's further litigation in the future to make clear what our legislative intent is?
From my perspective, no. I think it's all been put on the record pretty much as it is. If we were to put something on the record, the court's going to look at the language, and generally, I mean, I could be wrong to some degree on that, but that's generally what I've been told, so it's pretty much in the language. And so our intent is essentially to make sure that the situation that we've been discussing, you know, doesn't happen, and that the lenders aren't able to foreclose on a first trust deed for the value of a residential property where the value is been foreclosed upon, and the property was originally purchased with a first and second, and then the second it remains as a deficiency, and the lender then sues on the note to collect on that deficiency after the house has been foreclosed upon, because there is no value left in the property at that point. And Representative Barton, do you want to help clarify that intent?
If I may, Mr. Chair, the first thing the court will look at if this statute is ever litigated is literally the statute itself, the quote plain language of the statute. And if it means obviously to the court one thing, the case is over. Regardless, even if what the court believes it, that means, even if we intend something else, the language speaks for itself. It's only if, for example, a particular word in it or a particular part of it is ambiguous, that i.e. it could be reasonably read to mean one thing or the other. And only then does the court look at secondary sources. One of those secondary sources would be the legislative history, the record that we create here today. So in general, when we're trying to kind of establish legislative history, the best way to do it is not so much our intent on the overhaul bill, although that can be useful occasionally. It's if there's a particular passage or word that might be ambiguous, or you mean the word to mean something different than it might ordinarily mean, or something like that, then it's a very good place to put to establish legislative history, because it might be litigated.
Thank you. And it is the intent to have the words inserted, and I will follow this over to the Senate side to make, since I'm instructed I can't do conceptual amendments, which I'm really tempted to do at this point in my life, but of fixing on page 3, line 18, deleting the word is, and inserting the word was, and in front of the word trustee, putting original. And that's pretty much it as I understand it, and I'm comfortable moving forward with the bill with that explanation. And Representative Barton, did you volunteer to carry this bill?
I heard him. I thought so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you're welcome.
Representative Clem
might have an interest in it.
Might want to co-carry it, but our intent...
I'll defer to Representative Clem out of respect to him.
I think Representative Barton should.
Yeah, Representative Barton will carry the bill. And with that, I'll close the work session on House Bill 3004. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2784. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Chip Shields, State Representative, District 43, North and Northeast Portland. You may recall that when I was before you previously, I testified that House Bill 2784 was all about providing a systematic way to ask questions in a public forum about state charter banks and TARP funding. And by the way, I do have some... And also, as part of that testimony, there were two other people testifying. One was Michelle Rann, owner of Cascade Investments, who lives in Estacada, incidentally, and has 30 years in the finance and bank and trust business, and basically saw House Bill 2784 as a shareholder rights and transparency bill. And then we also heard from Bill Black, former legal counsel to the bank board, who helped oversee the kind of the rebuilding after the savings and loan debacle in the 1980s, who suggested that this bill was a good idea because the federal oversight just simply wasn't happening. So basically I'm here today, Mr. Chair, to explain, ask you to take the Dash 1 amendments and move the bill. And I just wanted to walk you through the Dash 1s that are in the packet of information I gave you. I presume you also have a copy of them there. But essentially what the Dash 1s do is what I conceptually described to you at the last hearing, which is that I believed it was overkill to provide a task force related to state chartered banks that receive TARP funding, primarily because when I originally did the bill, it was uncertain when the TARP 2 funds came around whether or not there would be three banks or, you know, 15, 20 banks who would go after that. So I listened to the Bankers Association, decided, yes, that would be a little bit over the top. What we decided to do is to strip that out, also strip out the information about regulation of state chartered banks that receive TARP funding. And I also want to underline this is a bipartisan bill. Representative Girard and Representative Smith are still supportive as in our House chamber. And so what this bill basically does is require those banks that are receiving TARP funding to just come before interim committees and tell their story, and tell us what they've done with the money. I think it's a basic oversight and accountability bill, Mr. Chair, and I think it's good public policy.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Representative Shields, just a couple quick questions, because I know you've amended the bill now, and it's gone from kind of a task force to a presentation during the interim. And I guess, you know, my question, the question that I've had brought forward from my district would be, don't they currently have an obligation to appear before us and ask or answer our questions now anyway, meaning these state chartered banks? So don't we have the authority now, whether it be the interim committee or during regular session, special session, to have them appear before the committee and ask them the questions, to hold them accountable in this arena? And so that's what's being asked of me.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, the Bankers Association brought this up before. They said they're willing to do this, so why do we need a bill? Well, I would say if you're willing to do this, why not have a bill? And I think what this does is it adds some weight and legitimacy to this, that the legislature has weighed in on behalf of our constituents, who I think if you walked into a local business in your district and said, hey, there's a bill up in the legislature that would require that banks who receive TARP funding come and tell us what they've done with the money, do you think that's reasonable? I think most businesses would say, yeah, it is. So I would just kind of turn the question around. If they're willing to do this, I don't see what objection they would have to the bill, frankly.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up.
I think the question, this comes from M Bank in my community, where a gentleman serving on the board is actually had worked in the building prior to, but to them it's just one more bill. Kind of a sharp stick in the eye. Why do we need a law on something we've already agreed on the record? This committee is going to be together in the interim. You'd even like to sit on that committee too. I'm just kind of, you know, again, and I think, you know, I have a great deal of respect for you. I'm just trying to get a feel for if this is actually offending the people that we need on our side with our, you know, for our constituents, because I think we're all on board with asking the questions. I'm just wondering if it takes the law to do that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Matthews, I understand your point. I think that I'm sorry that the Bankers Association has seen it as a poke in the eye. And what I was hoping would happen is that once I offered this as a potential compromise, that they would just say, yeah, you know, we'd be happy to come and lock arms with you, and we're more than pleased to tell our story about what we've done with the funds in kind of a systematic, legitimized forum through the legislative process. So I don't see it as a poke in the eye. I see it as basic accountability for in us to systematically be able to ask questions about where taxpayer dollars are spent. And I see it, frankly, as a pro-business bill, because, again, I think that for the businesses, you know, in your packet, you have an editorial from the Oregonian entitled A Perfect Metaphor for the Banking Crisis. And the Oregonian went through, and I'll quote from the last three paragraphs of their story. It says, yes, it's a mistake to oversimplify what's going on. It is, as we said on this last page last week, tremendously difficult to calculate the manifold effects of an infusion of money into a complex and interlocking financial system, especially in a relatively short period of time. Nonetheless, we learned this week that the $700 billion in bank bailout money approved by Congress last fall has dwindled to about $135 billion. And this was the most important point, in my view. It seems fair to ask where the money has gone. And I think to do so in a legitimized way where a bill has been passed is appropriate. And I think we just have a difference of opinion with I've been a proud depositor at Albina Community Bank for a long time, and I think they just have a different interpretation of what we're trying to get at here.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope the banks don't see this as a poke in the eye. I don't see it that way. One of the things that I've been concerned about since I've been in the legislature, this is my third term, and I'm not an old-timer here, but I've been around for three terms now, and one of the things I'm concerned about always is our lack of oversight. We go through these sessions very quickly. We put in about 3,000 or 4,000 laws and bills and pass a few hundred of them. And we don't really spend much time on oversight. And I'd like to see us do more of that. I hope no one thinks that it's a poke in the eye. I hope everyone understands that we feel an obligation to our constituents, and I just wanted to get that on the record. Thank you.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Shields, like I say, I thank you for bringing this before us before. I'm not a strong supporter of it. I wasn't a big in favor of bailing the banks out to begin with the TARP dollars and everything with taxpayer dollars. But I think before we go looking into businesses and how they're operating, I think we need to be accountable with state government dollars, because there's lots of taxpayers that feel like we're poking them in the eye because we're not accountable with the funds that we have here, because a lot of them didn't like us bailing the banks out, yet we went ahead and did it anyway. So I like that we're bringing attention to this, but I can't support it, because we're not keeping things in line here. We won't even put up a public website to let people know where their tax dollars are going. And we have lots of money that disappears around here over and over again that we can't account for and can't let people know where it goes. So, and we come here as a legislature, and we don't even get to see where it goes. We get round numbers, and I think we need to clean our own house before we start cleaning businesses' houses. And that's my statement for the record.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would like to say I absolutely agree with half of what the Vice Chair said, and that is that we do need to clean our own house, and we do need to do more oversight on agencies and where the money that we spend goes and account for it. That's a separate issue, not the same issue in sequence.
Representative Shields, I don't see any more questions for you. I appreciate you coming forward. I want to call up Mr. Martinez if he'd like to comment on the bill before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good evening, Mr. Martinez.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry, we're cutting into the evening hour.
What time does the Blazers game start?
About 7 minutes ago.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I don't want to get in the way of the Blazers game, so I'll try to be brief, but I do feel compelled, here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, I do feel compelled to make some comments. I understand.
And your name for the record.
Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association. I do appreciate Representative Shields and Representative Riley hoping that this won't be seen as a poke in the eye. I'm here to tell you it is seen as a poke in the eye. If you've seen any of the comments that several banks have written or have been quoted in the paper about giving the money back because of issues just like this. This is not a bailout. The three banks in the state that got this did not get this as a bailout. They got it because they were healthy. The two banks that have already failed this year in Oregon would have loved to have this money, because in that case it would have been a bailout, and they asked for it. They were turned down. The three banks that got this money had to qualify for it, and they did not take it because they had any kind of lending issues, capital issues. They took it to help not only their local community, but to help businesses in their community get loans. So it's very frustrating to hear folks talk about this as a bailout. It's not. Pro-business, it's hard to see this as a pro-business bill. I'm sorry, I was sitting back there trying to figure out how possibly I could go back to my clients and say, you know what, this is really pro-business. I can't get there. I had a bite to eat, not knowing how long we were going to be here tonight, and I talked to a former member who served six terms in this building as a Democrat. And I asked that person, I said, you know, in your six terms, or in the time you've been lobbying since your six terms, have you seen a bill like this where you were instructed, not in a joint committee, but you were instructed tell the interim committee what they were going to do. And his response was, no, when I served, the committee chair and the presiding officer set their interim agendas. It is true, as Representative Shields has said, we've agreed that we will come here and talk about these issues. We disagree that a bill is necessary to do that. I assume that you may perhaps be the interim chair. I've made the same commitments to you. I've made the commitments to the business chair if it were to go there. We're happy to talk about it. I talked to several of you individually the other day. The first report came out of 250 pages. I offered to give, you know, print that out and provide it to anybody who wants it. You know, that's the type of stuff you're going to get from us, is those reports. On the oversight question that Representative Riley raised, we don't disagree with that, but you do have DCBS very actively involved in regulating banks. That is their job. You've delegated to them that job. They are the ones that help close the two banks in Oregon. They are the ones that, looking at the other banks that are still functioning and hopefully thriving, several of them are in this state. I know DCBS is not supportive of this bill. I don't see them here tonight. But again, I think you as chair and the presiding officer in both the House and the Senate certainly have the ability to suggest we ought to look at this issue in the interim, and we're happy to do so. But we think this bill does send a bad message and will be harmful and will be perceived as not only a poke in the eye, but really a lack of interest in the things that we are doing. So with that, I'll stop, because I would like to see the Blazers game as well tonight.
Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chair, I'm just...
Representative Tomei.
I just raised you to a different level. Tim, thank you for coming this evening and staying, and sorry to keep you from the game. So it sends a bad message. Transparency sends a bad message. Help me to understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, we've agreed to the transparency. We've agreed that we will appear before any committee. In fact, when the session started, my client testified before several committees about the state of banking and the state of lending in Oregon in 2009. We're prepared to do that. I just, in the years I've been here, and I've only been around here 20 years, but the years I've been here, I've never seen a bill like this that instructs an interim committee to simply have hearings. You know, so that's our frustration. I'm happy to give you everything that the federal government has or that banks are willing to share with you. We have shared that information with Representative Shields. I know he's had some good dialogue and some good letters back and forth between the banks that have taken this money to try to address his concerns. So we have no problem with transparency. We have a problem seeing the need for this bill to do that.
Follow up. I understand you're saying that you've never seen this in the 20 years you've been here. Well, I've been living on this earth for a very long time, and I don't remember any situation that we're having right now with the kind of fallout we're having with the economic industry. So I understand you've never been asked to do this before, but we've never seen this kind of situation before. So isn't it appropriate to have something different for a different situation? This is a different situation when banks are being given this money, this TARP money. What does it stand for? And so in different situations, it calls for different measures. So it seems to me it's appropriate if banks are being given this TARP money, that if in terms of transparency that I understand you say banks are willing to do, why wouldn't it be appropriate to require them to come to an interim committee to report on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, again, we don't disagree with reporting to an interim committee. I will tell you that there are banks in Oregon that have turned down taking these funds because of issues just like this.
Right.
When those banks turn down those funds, or should a bank give back the funds, you are harming lending in this state. You are taking money, capital, out of the bank,
So you're saying that because some banks have turned it down, they don't want to be transparent. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying that the burdens put on them after they take the money, because some of the banks, because of things like this, believe their communities are thinking they have been bailed out. And that was one of my first points. These banks that took the money have not been bailed out.
I understand that.
So I don't know what more to say.
I guess I just keep follow coming up. Back to follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, Chair. in terms of transparency, I understand that some banks weren't willing to take the TARP money because it looks bad for them to take that. But those who have agreed to take it, why wouldn't they be willing to be transparent?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, again, I would just say that all I believe, and I'm sure Representative Shields could answer this question, but I believe the requests he's made of the banks that took the money have been answered. I mean, they've corresponded. We met with him personally. He had follow-up questions that were answered. So it's not a matter of our unwillingness or desire not to be transparent. We are. The question is, do you need a bill to require that transparency? You know, at the end of the day, do you have to have legislation that goes through this committee, passes the floor, goes to the Senate, goes to the governor's desk, when we've both agreed that if an interim committee, and I've told Representative Shields that we're happy to sign a letter to the Speaker, if that happens to be Representative Holvey, or to the Speaker and the Chair of the committee, and say, look, we're happy to come before you at any time. You do not need a bill to have that happen. I think Representative Matthews stated that very well.
Thank you.
Representative Riley, anything else? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Speaker Holvey. Mr. Martinez, just quick question for you. If the banks that have taken the TARP funds right now could go back because it's federal dollars that they received, knowing that the states were going to jump in and start mandating, you're going to come in and tell us what you're doing with federal dollars and you're not dealing with federal government, do you think they would have made that decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, you know, I don't want to speak for them. I will tell you the conversations I've had and the media clips I've seen, the interviews that at least one of them has given, is that they are looking for a way to pay that money back as quick as they can. Because even though it has allowed them, in one case, to start a green lending program, to start a viticulture lending program, to start different new lending programs, stuff, issues like this and issues like what happens in Congress. You know, when you're a $500 million or a billion or even a $2 billion bank and you get tied up with AIG and Merrill Lynch and all these other folks that you really had absolutely nothing to do with, it gets very frustrating. One bank did not decide to take the money for this reason and because the top 25 people in their bank would be subject to income limitations and would be subject to certain compensation strategies. 25 people in that bank got just above the teller level. And so it didn't make any sense for them to put those compensations, because they do have a very aggressive compensation strategy based on selling. And they decided not to do that in addition to this reason.
Thank you. It looks like we've exhausted our comments and questions for you, Mr. Martinez. I'm also hopeful that this transparency is not seen as a poke in the eye, and I recognize that you fear that the banks will see it as such, but you know that in as much as you know these are taxpayer dollars and people want to you know have transparency on how those taxpayer dollars are being used, I'm not opposed to this particular bill, and I hope that we will get to understand the industry better in this process. So with that, I'm going to recess for just a minute or two here.
Thank you.
Are we out of recess?
Oh, excuse me. Thank you.
Here we go.
Reconvene the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendment dated 4-2009.
To House Bill
2784.
Representative Tomei moves we adopt the -1 amendments to House Bill 2784. Discussion? Seeing none. Is there objection? No objection. The -1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2784 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2784 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. Discussion? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill concerns me quite a bit, even though I like the idea of bringing attention to this because I don't, like I said before, I didn't like the bailouts. But I think we're sending a very bad message to business in the state of Oregon. These dollars were given from the feds. The feds are the ones who should be monitoring this. And with them taking the dollars and then us jumping in the middle of the game and saying, oh, by the way, now you're going to come report to the state, I don't think it's the right message we need to be sending to business. And especially after it's done, this should have been done before the money was ever given out. And we should have these rules in place before the game started and not change the games in the middle of the rules in the middle of the game. That's my opinion. That's why I won't be supporting this bill today.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'm supporting this because I think it's an important message to give to the public that we expect transparency in government. We expect transparency in state government. We would hope to have transparency in federal government. And certainly when there is money that is taxpayer money coming into our state, our taxpayers have a right to know where that money is going and how it is being used. So I'll vote yes on this bill.
Thank you. Cindy, could we have a roll call in reverse alphabetical order, please?
Representative Ware?
Excused.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Matthews?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative
Gilliam?
Excused.
Representative Cowan?
I'm going to give a courtesy yes, but reserve the right to vote no on the floor.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Widener?
No.
Vice Chair Riley?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Chair votes aye. House Bill 2784, having received the required votes, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Shields will carry the bill. Thank you, committee. We have, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2784 and open a work session on House Bill 2932. Committee, I'd like to move this bill to rules. And don't really need any discussion on the bill.
And not the due pass recommendation or no recommendation.
I'd like to move it with no recommendation. So are we in work session? I already opened it.
You opened it, yes.
Representative Riley.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2932 to the floor with no recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Representative Riley moves House Bill 2932 to the floor with no recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the bill is moved to the Committee on Rules. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2932. Thank you, committee. With that, I'm going to adjourn. Oh. What? I'm not adjourning?
See you tomorrow.
Nope.
Not yet? Okay, yeah.
Going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.